Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our Vatican Weekend feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, The Pope and the People. We have a report on Pope Francis's general audience, where he said Christians should look to God to console them when faced with the sorrows and sufferings of our times. Throwing down the gauntlet. That's how a Catholic humanitarian agency describes the Pope's call to politicians in his message for the upcoming World Day of Migrants and Refugees. Remembering the Smiling Pope. A report that looks back at why Pope John Paul I made such an impact during his brief papacy, to coincide with the anniversary of his election. And Black Madonna of Yasna Gora. On the feast day of Our Lady of Częstochowa, we find out more about this much-revered icon in Poland. We begin our broadcast with a report on Pope Francis's general audience, where he said Christian hope means looking to God for consolation when faced with the tragedies and sufferings of our time. The Pope referred to tragedies that can prompt us to lose hope, such as the recent deaths in Barcelona or in the Democratic Republic of Congo, or the plight of children and refugees. Lydia Kane reports.
Pope Francis, during his general audience on Wednesday, expressed his closeness to those affected by a magnitude 4 earthquake that hit the island of Ischia off the coast of Italy on Monday night. At least 2 people were killed and 3 young children, including a 7-month-old baby, were pulled from the rubble by firefighters. One of the victims was an elderly woman who was in a church that crumbled in the disaster. Dozens of people were injured when the quake struck and around 2,600 people were left homeless. The Holy Father prayed for the dead and injured. He also prayed for their families and all those who lost their homes.
Preghiamo per i morti, per i feriti, per i rispettivi familiari.
During the audience, the Pope also continued his catechesis on Christian hope, reflecting on the hope contained in our ultimate destination, the heavenly kingdom of God. Pope Francis explained that on life's pilgrimage, we encounter the God of surprises, who treats us with infinite tenderness, like a father welcoming his children home after a long and difficult journey. He went on to say, even if many experience life as a prolonged period of suffering, such as people haunted by violence and war, there is still a father who weeps with infinite compassion for his children and who waits to console them with a very different future. He noted in particular the recent attacks in Barcelona and sad news coming out of the Democratic Republic of Congo that made headline news.
Dopo aver visto il telegiornale o la copertina dei giornali dove ci sono tante tragedie.
Among those present in the Paul VI Hall on Wednesday were many English-speaking pilgrims. The Holy Father had a special greeting for pilgrims from the Cardin Community International on the 50th anniversary of the death of Cardinal Joseph Cardin. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Throwing down the gauntlet to politicians. That was how a Catholic aid agency described Pope Francis's message for the Church's upcoming World Day of Migrants and Refugees. The message was entitled Welcoming, Protecting, Promoting and Integrating Migrants and Refugees, and urged political leaders to do more to protect these displaced people, saying contemporary migration is a global issue that needs a global response. The Holy Father called for a shared response between politicians, civil society and the Church to tackle this issue. Graham Gordon is head of policy at the UK-based Catholic agency CAFOD. He told Lydia Kane that the Pope is making clear that all countries must step up to the plate and pull their weight when it comes to the ongoing migration crisis.
Well, I think it's a very timely message because the Pope is again clearly speaking into one of the great challenges of our times. And I think, again, it's interesting because it's quite a political message with a clear call to governments to step up their political will to deal with the issue of migration that we face now.
It is. It's more of an unusual message in the sense that he does really pinpoint. I mean, he pinpoints people of goodwill, but he does go for the political leaders as well, doesn't he?
That's right. And I think so. Again, as we've seen in Laudato Si, he goes for people of goodwill, but there's a very clear focus towards political leaders. And I think connected with the message and the 20 action points that have come out, it's very policy specific, which I think, again, is slightly unusual and welcome, because it's really drawing on the experience of the Catholic Church globally around how the Church has welcomed and protected migrants and refugees, and using that basis to issue a very clear call to governments that we're not doing enough to deal with one of the crises of our times, what he calls a sign of our times.
Yes, he does pinpoint four verbs in this document. He talks about welcome, protect, promote and integrate. With regard to those, what particular points did you find actually interesting?
Well, I think the very clearly there's a strong sense of protecting, and again, protecting the most vulnerable people who are on the move. So we see many examples of children, so up to half of the people who are migrating from, or who are refugees in some contexts, are children who are under 18. And our experience with CAFOD, with the communities we work with in Lebanon or in Colombia, is that they are the people who often need the most protection. So to avoid arbitrary detention, or to avoid detention based on the situation of their parents. And also those who are yet to be born, who, if they're born in refugee camps, may actually struggle to get a nationality. So a real focus on speaking for those who may struggle to speak for themselves in these situations.
I mean, we've seen the Pope in the past. One of the first things he did was to go to Lampedusa and see the migration crisis there. He also has taken it upon himself, this new dicastery.
That's right. I think this is clearly, migration is one of the issues that Pope Francis has decided he wants to define his papacy, and a very keen interest in this new dicastery. And I think Father Michael Czerny and Father Fabio Baggio, who head it up, are really doing great work around the world, trying to mobilize governments to respond and trying to mobilize the Church to respond. So yes, I think, again, the Pope is looking at one of the issues where he sees there's a lack of political commitment, and seeing that he can play a role that nobody else has been able to so far.
What do you think a message like this will have on world leaders?
Well, I think it depends which world leaders you're speaking to. So, for example, many African world leaders, or African leaders like, say, in Kenya or in Uganda, who are really struggling to cope with the influx of refugees from neighbouring countries, I think we'll see it as very welcome, because it's a call to the international community to step up their political and financial commitment to support people in transit, to support people who have been forcibly removed from their countries. Other countries, maybe like the US or some European countries, may see it as too much of a challenge, or quite a challenge to them. But I'm very much hoping that they will see what the Pope is saying as needing to respond to an issue that really defines how we are as human beings, because it's really seeing how we define the humanity and how we respond to those who are really in situations of vulnerability, and how we can treat them as fellow human beings with all the rights and dignity of all human beings.
He talks about these global compacts on refugees and migrants. He really, it's a kind of a call to arms as well for kind of people of goodwill, but also believers, Christians, to help out, in a sense, to help get them approved, as it were.
That's right. And these global compacts, one on migration and one on refugees, that are due to be agreed next year at the United Nations, are really key. And they are really going to be done very quickly, because if you look at other global agreements like the Sustainable Development Goals or the Paris Climate Change Agreement, that was years of negotiations, and really we've got less than 12 months now to deal with migration and refugees. So he really wants to inject a sense of urgency into getting clear agreement, and wanting to speak to governments as well as you say, the Church and other groups in society about how we can all respond together. And I think, interestingly, he calls it a global issue that needs a global response. And again, he's saying we can't just leave it to governments, but he's also saying on the other side, we can't just leave it to the church and other civil society groups. Actually, we need to work in partnership again to tackle this issue.
So in a sense, to summarise, what he really is talking about is a shared response for all these parties, all these actors to play their part.
That's right. It's very clear shared response. It's a political response. It's also a financial response, but also a compassionate response. And I think just as in Laudato Si, he called us to look at our own impact on the environment, on the planet. He's looking in this, he's calling us to look at how we also interact with, as he calls, the stranger, how we interact with refugees and migrants who are maybe even living next door to us. And I think it's a very clear call to us as individual Christians, as parishes, but also as political actors.
And that was Graham Gordon of the UK-based Catholic agency CAFOD, speaking to Lydia O'Kane. And now, let's step back in time and look at the figure of a pope who captured so many people's hearts, despite reigning for only a month.
Habemus Papam. Eminentissimum ac reverendissimum Dominum Albinum Sancte Romane Ecclesiae Cardinalem Luciani.
It was August the 26th, 1978, the year which has gone down in recent history as the year of the three popes. After one of the shortest conclaves ever held, the cardinal electors had chosen the then Patriarch of Venice, Cardinal Albino Luciani, to head the See of Peter. He was the first pope to take the names of both of his immediate predecessors, John the 23rd and Paul the 6th, whose death had occurred earlier that same month. It also marked the first time that a pope had chosen to take a double name.
Devo cercare di servire la Chiesa.
But who was Pope John Paul I? And what impact did he have during his brief papacy? Born in the northeastern Veneto region of Italy, Albino Luciani was the son of a poor labourer. At an early age, he decided to become a priest, and after more than 30 years of service in the church, was appointed Patriarch of Venice in 1969. Less than 4 years later, he was given a cardinal's hat by Pope Paul VI. He was elected to the papacy when aged 65. During his 33 days as pope, John Paul I quickly won over the crowds with his personal warmth and open manner, and became known as the Smiling Pope.
Ieri mattina io son andato alla Sistina a votare.
On the day after his election, during his Angelus address to the crowds jammed into St. Peter's Square, Pope John Paul I revealed how he went along calmly to the conclave to vote. Never, he said, had he expected the outcome that occurred, and that he would be the one chosen to be the next pope.
Appena è cominciato il pericolo per me.
He drew laughs from the crowd when he spoke of how, during the balloting, he soon saw, as he put it, the danger approaching him, and described how two fellow cardinals whispered words of support and encouragement to him.
Se il Signore dà un peso, darà anche l'aiuto per portarlo.
The late Cardinal William Baum of Washington later described to Vatican Radio the special quality of Pope Albino Luciani's 33-day rule.
His pontificate, although brief, was, from our point of view, a moment of grace. The world reacted with great joy to the election of John Paul I. I remember that with great satisfaction. Immediately, the world embraced him. He had that ability to communicate, even without words. I believe that's correct. He again appeared to everyone as the great, what he was, as a very loving father.
Given the popularity of the new pope and the fact that he was only in his mid-60s, it came as a huge shock to everyone when he suddenly died one night, barely a month after his election. Not surprisingly, people reacted with total disbelief when, for the second time that summer, the bells of St. Peter tolled for the death of a pope. One of those who couldn't believe the news at first was the late US Cardinal John Foley, who told us how he reacted on being told that the new pope had died.
Well, I had a great sense of disbelief. I remember I was at home and somebody knocked at my door at 4 a.m. and said, "The pope died." And I said, "I know the pope died. You know, they elected a new one a month ago." And they said, "No, that pope died." You know, I couldn't believe it.
Similar disbelief came from Cardinal Baum when he was told the news of Pope John Paul I's untimely passing.
One of my priests called me. It was about 2:30, 2:45 in the morning. And he wakened me from a dead sleep. And he said, "I'm sorry to call you, but I think you should know the Pope has died." And my first reaction is, "You're mistaken. You must have been listening to a program about the death of Pope Paul VI.
Dear sons and daughters, your presence is a great joy for me because I love you all very much."
George Weigel is a US Catholic scholar and Vatican expert and the biographer of Pope John Paul II. I phoned Weigel up to ask him to share with us his own memories of Pope Luciani and help us shed some more light on the figure of the man who touched the hearts of so many during his brief time as head of the Catholic Church.
Love is like a journey in which we run to...
I think the first reaction that I and many others had at the election of Cardinal Luciani as John Paul I was how quickly it was done. This was one of the most rapid conclaves in history. There obviously was a consensus in favor of Cardinal Luciani that had formed between the death of Pope Paul VI and the immurement of the conclave. And those who were expecting a more protracted electoral process were the first surprised people. Secondly, I think it's fair to say that Cardinal Luciani was not particularly well known in the church in the United States, for sure. And the initial self-presentation of this man, a holy, smiling, self-confident pastor, did a great deal to dissipate the fog that seemed to have settled over the church in the first 8 years of the 1970s. He was like a ray of sun, and I think was very well received because of that.
Yes, I mean, in fact, he quickly became known as the smiling pope. He very much impressed people, didn't he, with this very genuine and personal warmth and his candor as well, the way he spoke in his speeches.
He was a brilliant catechist. He was a man who had an ability to express the enduring truths of Catholic faith in an accessible way, using examples and illustrations that made sense to people who didn't necessarily have much theological training or even catechetical formation. And at a time in the history of the church when catechetical work had fallen on hard times, when religious education was not in particularly good shape, when there were a lot of questions about whether it was in fact possible to make the Christian offer, to make the Christian proposal in a way that made sense, the month-long pontificate of John Paul I demonstrated that you could do that, and that you could do it particularly effectively if it was done with a smile, if it was done with a sense of Christian joy.
He was quite a trailblazer in his own way because, for instance, he was the first pope to speak in the singular form using the I form instead of the more regal we. And he was also the first pope to reject the traditional papal coronation with a tiara, opting instead for a more simplified papal inauguration mass. What does all this say about him to us?
I think it says that he was part of a process that had been going on, in fact, I believe, since Leo XIII, in which the papacy was being redefined as an office of witness, an office of evangelism, much less an office of management, and still less an office of power as the world understands power. Beginning with Leo XIII, the popes begin to deploy a new form of power, the power of moral argument. And I think Cardinal Luciani had the intuition that the tiara symbolized an older expression of the papacy that was fading from the historical scene and that was really not necessary to symbolically represent the essence of the office. The essence of the office lay in the role of the Pope as teacher and witness to the truth of God in Christ.
It is about love that I want to speak to you today. Love.
In his general audiences and his Angelus addresses and the few speeches he made as Pope, he spoke a lot about Christian love, didn't he?
Well, he was a man who understood that the church had come to be taken by the world as a naysayer, as an institution that was constantly saying no to this, no to that. Now, the church has to say no on many occasions, but as John Paul I also understood that the church's no to whatever is always based on a yes, and that yes is the affirmation of God's infinite love for the world, manifest in Christ the Lord and Redeemer.
Now, talking of course, this surprising death and everything, there were, of course, all the conspiracy theories about his sudden death, that he was murdered. I mean, do you think the church was somewhat baffled by all that?
I think what the church should have learned from all of that is that it is important to know the medical conditions, the health conditions of possible candidates for the papacy. This man who clearly, in retrospect, had serious circulatory problems that were sooner or later going to have the lethal effect that they did 33 days into his papacy, that these things should not have been recognized and attended to. I think that's the lesson from serious journalistic inquiries into the death of John Paul I, which I think have exploded the conspiracy theories, but have underscored a rather dramatic lack of competent medical attention at the time of his election and throughout the months of his papacy.
So, if you had to sum up in one or two sentences this very brief papacy of Pope John Paul I, how would it be?
I would say that he was part of a century-long transition in the office of the papacy from a regal and managerial office to an evangelical and pastoral office. I would say that in that brief month, he showed the joy and love that is at the heart of Christian life in a way that the church had perhaps not demonstrated. Throughout the 1970s, which were a very difficult time of contention inside the church. And I think, frankly, the shock of his death created the human conditions for the possibility of the election of a non-Italian, which is, of course, what happened in the election of Karol Wojtyła as John Paul II.
I was speaking to George Weigel, Vatican expert and biographer.
L'amore sarà sempre vittorioso. L'amore può tutto.
Known as the Black Madonna of Częstochowa, this much-revered wooden icon depicting the Blessed Virgin Mary and the child Jesus is found at the Jasna Góra Monastery in Poland that was visited by Pope Francis in 2016. There's a legend that the image was made by St. Luke, who was said to have used the wood from a table built by Jesus during his time as a carpenter. According to this same legend, St. Helen came across this image of Our Lady during a visit to Jerusalem and gave it to her son, Constantine. The image has had a turbulent history during the many conflicts of the past centuries and bears the scars from being hit once by an arrow and being struck twice by a sword. Located in the heart of Poland, the Black Madonna icon has become a symbol of the nation, revered by its faithful and also by the Polish diaspora around the world. The Jasna Góra Monastery is home of the Order of St. Paul the First Hermit, or the Pauline Fathers. Speaking at the shrine, the Father General of the Order, Father Arnold Czapkowski, talked about the devotion to the icon among his compatriots.
Shrine of Our Lady at Jasna Góra is not connected with any apparitions. It was created from the popular piety of the faithful, who coming to this place have experienced many graces through the intercession of Mary, the Mother of God. The icon of the Black Madonna, as we traditionally call her, venerated not only by the Polish people, but the faithful from all the world.
This international outreach has had an effect on the order, as the Black Madonna has inspired vocations around the world. David de Lamini, a Pauline father from South Africa, explains.
For me, Black Madonna came also in South Africa, brought by the Trappist. It was 1885, but it was not so popular, the picture of Our Lady, until the Pauline fathers came in 1991. So they were explaining to us as the South African people in the South African Częstochowa, which was also founded by the Trappist before. So for us, she's our mother.
Pauline brother Jeremy Santos, who is preparing for the priesthood, comes from Australia. He too speaks about the inspirational quality of this deep-rooted devotion to the Black Madonna among Poles.
I remember the first time being here in Poland when I was a postulant entering into the novitiate, and my impression of Jasna Góra was remarkable because how big the monastery is and the amount of people at the time that was walking around, how so many people were praying the Hail Mary and how so many people were there just to pray to the Black Madonna. And I was impressed for their devotion and faith, and I thought that the faith here in Poland is actually really, really huge and really magnificent, and it's so beautiful to witness such a thing that it kind of slowly motivated me, inspired me to love the country all the more.
That was Pauline brother Jeremy Santos, and earlier you heard the voices of Pauline father David de Lamini and the Father General of the Order, Father Arnold Czapkowski, interviewed by Lydia O'Kane. And that's all we got time for in today's programme. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudator Jesus Christus.